This is Regionally Speaking on Lakeshore Public Radio. I'm Chris Nolte. Franciscan Health is working in a national study that is being spearheaded by the Mayo Clinic to look into how effective what is called convalescent plasma is in trying to treat patients who've been infected with COVID-19. We have with us Dr. Erica Kaufman-West, who's the infectious disease specialist for Franciscan Health, to talk about it. And Dr. Kaufman-West, thank you for being with us today.
You're quite welcome.
Well, first, for people that do not know what convalescent plasma is, how important is it, especially in these days with COVID-19?
Our plasma in general is filled with antibodies and other valuable proteins that our body creates in order to fight off various illnesses that we come in contact with. The notion of convalescent plasma is not a new one. It's been around for a couple hundred years, and the idea is if you take someone's antibodies that's already been exposed to a disease and give them to somebody who's suffering from that disease, that those antibodies can neutralize the infection allowing that person to recover faster.
Mm-hmm. Now, does the FDA recognize convalescent plasma as something that can help? To see if it will probably work in this instance, but probably in other infectious instances too?
This particular study did get, did go through the FDA as a sort of a new investigational treatment. Mm-hmm. So the FDA is aware of the notion of convalescent plasma. Up until this point, this is, to my knowledge, the largest sort of single registry looking at convalescent plasma. Up until now, it had sort of been smaller, individualized institutions sort of doing their own little pieces to mm-hmm. see if this might work against other viruses, such as H1N1 in the past or the, first SARS epidemic in the early 2000s. So it's not a new notion to the FDA, but this sort of grand scale is definitely new.
Now, we should mention that the point is that if you have gone through being a patient or at least having received a treatment of some type, or if you have actually contracted COVID-19, if you've recovered from it, you've got, of course, the antibodies in your body, I guess, that will certainly show themselves eventually. But the plasma is still good. And in fact, any blood that is received is still going to be good. We'll talk about on how to be able to donate plasma in just a moment, but what are the ways that taking advantage of this plasma are to researchers like yourselves and others working on this particular project to see if it will indeed do what you hope it will?
Yeah, so I mean, there's so many questions that this can help us answer. The first question, obviously, is can antibodies to the SARS-CoV-2 virus, can antibodies to that virus neutralize the virus? And that's something that we all hope is the case. That would lead us to believe there's some sort of immunity that one would get from having been infected by the virus. So, that'll be the first question is can these antibodies neutralize the virus?
Mm-hmm.
The second question is what does that mean? Does it help people to avoid those severe cases, keep people off the ventilator, keep people from dying? Does it decrease the length of time that they're suffering from their illness? So do they get out of the hospital faster? Are they back to their typical routines faster? And then the question will be, at what point is this treatment best given? Is it best given in the first 72 hours? Can it still be effective after 2 or 3 weeks of illness? And then who benefits most? Is it young people, old people, people of different races or genders? Is it more effective if you've got comorbidities, for example? Or are those people the ones that are going to benefit most? So the benefit of a study this size is you'll have the sort of diversity of patients to be able to look at all of those factors and say, okay, who in the future would we prioritize this therapy to? Obviously, we are very much indebted to folks who are generous enough to donate their plasma.
Mm-hmm.
So at least at this point, this is not something that we can just make in a lab and pump out and just create as many doses as we want.
Yeah.
So knowing that there will be a limited supply, who is going to be benefiting most from it, that is hopefully questions that will be answered.
Now, obviously, getting the plasma from one's blood system starts out with donating blood. What is the difference, by the way, for folks that may not be familiar with just donating blood at the blood center and the plasma being taken about and used in this particular project?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so when you donate blood, you donate everything. You donate your platelets, your plasma, your red blood cells, the whole thing. We typically think of blood donation as being a red blood cell donation, and that's the majority of what is used and what benefits people.
Mm-hmm.
But all of those other components of the blood are sort of pooled together and can be used as needed. When you're talking about donating plasma, the red blood cells are given back to the donor, and just the plasma is taken. So the idea is similar. It takes a little bit longer because they, you know, have to give you your red blood cells back. But if you've ever given blood before, it won't be that different of an experience.
I see. What's in this case? This any special requirements that you have to follow aside from the usual ones for donating blood?
Mm-hmm. No, just the usual ones of donating blood. You have to obviously know that you were infected with SARS-CoV-2. So obviously, in this case, when we're talking about plasma donation, we want people that have antibodies. So you have to have had a test that's positive at least 14 days prior. You have to be feeling well. We don't want anybody that's sick coming in. You have to be feeling well and at least 14 days past the date of your test. And then just the general, you know, standard blood donation requirements. Obviously stay hydrated on the day of your donation, just like you would with a regular blood cell.
Now, I know that Vercidi is the Franciscan Health's blood supplier, so I'm guessing that you'd have to get in touch with them to set up an appointment to be able to donate?
Yes, that's exactly right. Vercidi has on their website a whole lot of information about donating plasma and what it takes and how to do that. The Franciscan website, I'm sure you'll be able to get that information to folks, has a step-by-step process so that we can, especially if you've gotten your COVID test with us, we'll be able to help validate that with Vercidi and make it even easier for you to get to the donation center.
Mm-hmm. When did Franciscan Health get involved in this national study working with the Mayo Clinic, and how long does the study run?
Well, we probably got started about 4 weeks ago or so, and the took some time, obviously, to get through the protocols and everything and to get physicians signed up. We all have to, you know, do particular training to be able to do this. So we've been probably able to do the donations now for about the last two and a half weeks. How long will it run sort of depends on what the Mayo Clinic finds. So they did an initial analysis for safety, and they found that there were no increased adverse events or anything that would cause them to stop the study early. I don't know that they have a predefined, you know, number of patients that where they would stop the study. My understanding is that they'll continue to enroll and analyze the data at a certain point to see if they can answer some of those questions that we went through already.
Dr. Erica Kaufman-West is an infectious disease specialist for Franciscan Health here in Northwest Indiana. And thank you very much, Dr. Kaufman-West, for the information. And we hope that folks donate their blood and are able to take advantage of this national study to find out what benefits the convalescent plasma might have in dealing with COVID-19.
Thank you, and thanks for highlighting our important work.
This is Lakeshore Public Radio, 89.1 FM. A teenager here in Northwest Indiana has taken the dream of a youth center to the next level. And let's find out more about the young lady who is interested in the youth center in the city of Gary. Aaliyah Stewart is with us. She's with her family members in Maryville right now. Thanks for joining us on Regionally Speaking.
Thank you for having me.
Give us an idea what got you started in thinking about a very ambitious project, because that's usually a youth center is something that a group of people end up having to start, but you've taken it on all by yourself, I guess, with some help from friends. Tell us how it all got started.
Well, first, give an honor to God, because it's all God that gives me the strength and the ideas to do the things that I do. Mm-hmm. I started my nonprofit organization at 14 years old. And now I'm 19, and I started it in honor of my two brothers that were killed due to senseless gun violence in Gary, Indiana. So what I wanted to do with the I Am Them Hope Youth Center was build a horizon for young people in the community to experience different and see different, and to learn how to express their potential and purpose, especially if they've been through trauma. So the idea of the center was to bring something positive to Gary, to be a light, a beacon of light for young people in my community.
I understand that you created the foundation. It's called the ASW Foundation, I guess, after the deaths of a couple of your brothers. Tell us, if you will, about Anthony White Jr. and about James Anderson and what kind of guys they were. And in turn, obviously, the tragedy is a good inspiration, but there had to be others, I'm sure.
Yes. Anthony was 16 years old when he was killed, and I was 7 years old. Anthony was so adorable. He was a ladies' man, very intelligent and athletic. He played basketball, baseball. He was into a lot of different things in Gary, like bitty ball, things like that, and he was graduating from Maryville High School. James, he was funny. That was the brother that was very funny. He was athletic as well. He played basketball at Bailey and a lot of different things like that. But James was very good with his hands. So trade was good for him. So that comes along with bringing trade into the youth center because he was very good with his hands and he loved music. So he was just talented. Both of them were very talented and handsome and loving in their own ways.
I understand that besides being a dutiful sister to both these guys, you're also a pretty good motivational speaker. Tell us how you got started in that, and how did that lead you in a way to help get the support that you needed to be able to create the Youth Center, which is to become a project very soon?
Well, I decided to do influential speaking my senior year of high school. My mom made me do advanced composition as part of my classes, and I just absolutely loved the way that I could tell my story, but I wanted to tell it on more of an intellectual platform. You know, I wanted to be able to speak at churches and political events, but also I wanted to relate to young people in the neighborhood. So I started speaking in 2015. My first speaking engagement was at Theo Bowman High School, so thank you to the principal there that allowed me to come and speak at. I was 14 years old. And that was my first speaking engagement. And then from that point on, I started speaking at other places and traveling to speak. And then my senior year, that's when I came up with I wanted to be full-time influential speaker.
I know that the ASW Foundation has been very, very busy in here in Northwest Indiana and in Gary and Maryville area in particular to try to stop the very senseless gun violence that's going on in the communities. And that, I'm sure, led you to contacts that you made over time that, in turn, the organization helped be able to get the lease for the 6,100-square-foot building that you looked at 2301 Virginia Street. Tell us a little bit about the neighborhood where the youth center will be built and how the project is coming along.
The project is going along great. We're working right now to get everything going and just trusting God with everything. Due to COVID-19, we've had to delay some things, but they're not denied. So that's good. And then we're right behind the Color Door Gary Housing Authority. So we're right behind those apartments. And we're very excited to get the kids to come over. We're excited for everyone to be a part. And so we're just working and praying and getting everything ready and done so that when COVID-19 is over, we can hopefully hurry and open so that the kids can have something to do.
That's a great opportunity to bring young people in since you're so close to the area where many of them live. And what kind of programs would you like to set up in the center itself once it's completed and ready to use?
So we have a couple of different programs that we'll be running. Early childhood development is one. Tutoring, college and career readiness, leadership and social development, engineering, media and technology, athletics and recreational, visual and performing arts. And we're also working on the name of a program to teach students about healthy choices in the field of eating, understanding that you are what you eat and your body is tired and drained by the things that we're putting inside of our body.
Now, obviously, an organization has to be able to raise the money. You have raised some, quite a bit already, $20,000, going toward some of the important things to start out with, building permits and supplies and startup costs and the like. But you're still out there looking for support. Tell us how support you're seeking and how it's coming along so far there.
a lot of people have been donating. So for anyone that's listening that would love to donate and support our vision or even donate time, come volunteer, come help or anything like that, please visit our website, which is iamthem.org, iamthem.org. To donate, you can go on our iamthem.org website and click the donate button, and it will take you to our GoFundMe. And from there, you can donate. If you just want to volunteer, you can go under community service on iamthem.org and send us an email, and I'll respond to it.
Well, Aaliyah, when do you hope that if things go well and the pandemic subsides a bit and more work gets to be done soon, when do you hope to have the youth center opened up?
I'm hoping towards the fall. If not the fall, towards the end of the year. But whenever it happens, it's going to be great.
Well, Aaliyah, thank you for spending time with us to tell us more about yourself and about the ASW Foundation that you've created and all of the work that has happened so far up to now and the selection of a site for a youth center in Gary. And we wish you the best, and we'll offer a few prayers as well, too, to help push things along. Thank you very much for talking with us today on Regionally Speaking.
Thank you so much for having me.
This is Regionally Speaking on Lakeshore Public Radio.
With another edition of Building Northwest Indiana, here's Kevin Comerford.
Thank you for joining us today for another episode of Building Northwest Indiana. My name is Kevin Comerford. I am the Director of Professional Development at the Construction Advancement Foundation of Northwest Indiana, and I will be your host today. The purpose of Building Northwest Indiana Radio is to give you a little insight into the Northwest Indiana professional construction industry. My guest today is Alex Lulinski. Alex is a senior project manager with Berglund Construction. Berglund Construction is a fourth-generation, family-owned and operated construction and building restoration firm. The company is headquartered in Chicago, but also has several satellite offices, including one in Chesterton, Indiana. Some of Berglund's notable projects in Northwest Indiana include Centier Bank headquarters in Merrillville, the Mascot Hall of Fame in Whiting, the William E. Urschel Pavilion in Valparaiso, the Stardust Event Center expansion at the Blue Chip Casino in Michigan City, and they are just about wrapped up on a new bioscience building at the Purdue Northwest campus in Hammond. Today, Alex and I will be talking about the responsibilities of a construction project manager. Alex, thanks for joining us today.
Thanks, Kevin, and thanks for having me.
So, can you provide our listeners with a little background about Berglund Construction? You know, what kind of company are you? What kind of work do you do?
Bergen Construction, we're a general contractor, a construction manager, and we do a lot of self-perform. We're spread out, not across the whole nation, but we're in Florida, Ohio, Indiana, Illinois, and Wisconsin. I work out of our Chesterton office, and we do GC and CM work out of that office. We also have a large restoration division with masons and tuck pointers where we, you know, restore a lot of the buildings of Chicago, Milwaukee. We're even up in Minnesota and over in Ohio.
Well, thanks for that background. So as a senior project manager, I know you're kind of working on the Purdue University Northwest Bioscience Building. Can you expand on how a project comes from an idea from the owner, and then how does it get to that construction phase, and where do you come in on that?
Well, it, depending on your owner, they choose their project delivery. There's several types of project deliveries. I'll go over a couple. There's design build, where you're hiring a contractor who has a team of an architect, and you design with the owner's input with the on-staff architect, and then you build that project. Several of them are design bid build, otherwise known as hard bid. Lump sum bidding, lowest number gets the job. Purdue Bioscience, that was a CMC project. They hired an architect through a selection process, selection interview process, and then they turn around and they hired Berglund. We submitted resumes and through that same process that they hired the architect with. And from there, once they hired both the architect and the CM, they had a budget. We were on board. We got involved way up front before there was conceptual drawings, basically just a couple of renderings. We then worked along with the architect and the owner, and we developed a set of drawings, set of floor plans within the owner's budget. And our role was to basically keep the architect within budget. Every set of drawings that they delivered, we would then go through and do our pricing exercises to ensure that they're within the budget of the owner. once we got to the construction documents, that's when we turn around and we put the drawings on the street for hard bids from the subcontractors from the bid packages we developed.
So how does that bid package work with your subs? Does the lowest bidder win out of your subs, or do you kind of have the opportunity to pick and choose the subs depending on who you like to work with?
It's lowest and best value. They submit clarifications to the proposal and they don't have the complete package or they exclude something. You have to look at what they have scoped and their value. So it is lowest and best value.
You went through the selection process of the subcontractors. The subcontracts have been rewarded to different contractors. Now, where does that take you? What's the next step of the project?
Well, the next step of the project is actually the construction itself. Now your subs are awarded. They've been through the pre-qualification process. They are qualified to perform the project. And now it's, you know, putting the shovel in the ground and starting the project. And being a project manager, there's a couple steps you have to take to get to there. You have to do your logistics planning, figure out how much space, you know, you're going to get from the owner, where you're going to have your site fence and everything else like that. Your schedule, when you're guaranteeing you're going to turn this job over to the owner. It's all part of the subcontracting process, too, that you need to complete all that, get it into the subcontract so they're aware of the project schedule. But now that all that is established, you're putting the shovel in the ground, and you're moving forward with the construction project.
That'll do it for today's edition of Building Northwest Indiana Radio. I would like to thank our guest, Alex Lulinski, Senior Project Manager with Berglund Construction. To find out more information about Berglund Construction, please visit berglundco.com.
That's Kevin Comerford, host of Building Northwest Indiana Radio, talking with Alex Lulinski, Senior Project Manager for Berglund Construction. Support for Building Northwest Indiana is brought to you by the Construction Advancement Foundation. Podcasts are also available at lakeshorepublicradio.org. You can hear part two of this conversation next week.
This next story comes to you from the Welcome Project at Valparaiso University. The Welcome Project collects first-person stories and pairs these with an intentional conversation to help forge stronger ties within and across our communities.
I grew up in the Midtown section of Gary. It was a place called the Small Farms, and it was called that for a reason, because where I lived, there were no sidewalks, there were no paved streets. I remember as a kid, we had cows and chickens and hogs and those kinds of things. Yeah, right here in Gary, Indiana. I grew up in an environment, a lot of people may find it hard to believe now when they look at you and suppose that you're, you know, in a different state. But I grew up in a household where the matriarch and patriarch of my household was my grandmother and grandfather. In fact, there were four adult families in my household. So I know what it's like to sleep seven deep. We didn't know any better. We thought everybody had to kind of compensate in that manner. And so it was a wonderful environment. I had three sisters, two brothers. But of course, if you cumulatively look at my household, counting my uncle and my cousins, then I probably had about 10 brothers and maybe eight sisters and a couple of mothers and fathers. It was not a typical environment, but we managed to make it nurturing. A typical day would actually have to get up and feed the chickens, get the eggs. In fact, we had to slop the hogs. We had dogs, of course, so you had to feed the dogs. And it just depends. If it was a school day, those things were done early. And when you got home, if there were any chores that needed to be done, of course they were done. You never told your parents you wouldn't do it. And if it was in the summertime, because it was an area, it was a wooded area, as I mentioned, the dirt roads, so there's a lot of house cleaning that had to take place. You had to pull weeds. I had to help my grandmother in the garden. I then had a wonderful childhood because we were able to get out into those streets. We played football in the street. We did things that others couldn't do with pavement and concrete as a hindrance to their playful activities. And so I was very, very pleased with the area in which I grew up. And of course, being in Gary at that time, it was an all-black community. It was also a community that was very well intertwined. I mean, when you talk about it takes a village, well, we had a village out there in the Small Farms. Everybody was everybody's parents. we played, we behaved, we conducted ourselves in a manner in which I think led to us, most of us, being successful adults. Now, we had our playful, youthful interactions, of course, and like any other kids, there's some things that we wouldn't tell our parents that we did. But all in all, it was a wonderful experience growing up in the small farms of Gary.
You can find more regional stories at welcomeproject.valpo.edu. This is Regionally Speaking on Lakeshore Public Radio. I'm Chris Nolte. It's been very difficult for people and organizations that are trying to plan for summertime festivals and other events to be able to plan for the future these days, with, of course, the COVID-19 pandemic still upon us. And not only that, but still we're under the stay-at-home orders from the governor's office. What are we doing here in Northwest Indiana to deal with it? Well, let's find out the latest from Spiros Batistatos. He's the president and CEO of the South Shore Convention and Visitors Authority. And Spiros, thank you for joining us on the show today.
Well, Chris, thank you for having me. I hope everyone there and your families are all safe and healthy.
Now, we're doing our best, that's to be sure. So, and as a lot of people are trying to do out here in Northwest Indiana, but it's not an easy chore to not only stay well, but keep a business afloat or keep an organization afloat, whether it's a profit or nonprofit facility. And then you've got, when you do plans for the summer months, what's the latest that you've seen and talked with your colleagues and your associates with the CVA?
Well, we're all running remotely. We're in daily contact with our hotels and many restaurants. What we've done, in essence, Chris, is flip on a dime. We've gone from an externally focused organization that communicates with publics, generally with marketing message and PR aimed at outside of Northwest Indiana. And on a dime, in mid-March, we flipped the laser focus internally to Northwest Indiana. So it's credit to this very talented team I get to work with, and we're really trying to keep all of our partners apprised of what future group business looks like as we get our sports events, our bookings. Some are holding solid. We talked about before we got on the air, the festivals. That's very understandable. Pierogi Fest, I talked to Tom Dabberton before he went public with his decision, and Tom and myself are probably, you know, managed two of the biggest events in Northwest Indiana, him, the Pierogi Fest, and us with the air show. And I'll tell you right now, if we were doing the air show still, we'd have canceled it as well.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's
too unpredictable right now. What the social distancing guidelines will look like, and you've got to put so much money out, so many contracts, so many commitments that have to be paid in advance. I mean, you know, people just show up to these events and they think, you know, they somehow miraculously pop up. But they literally, we would get done with one air show, Chris, and we would start the very next Monday planning for the next one.
Yeah, I know that Tom Dabberton's been in the same situation with Pierogi Fest. I know it's such a huge organization, and a lot of volunteer help is all involved in this. It's just very, very difficult to, like you say, to be able to turn on a dime, and you have to do it now.
So, you know, I'm confident it'll be back bigger than ever next year. I'm relatively confident our economy will come back quicker than any of us expect. But in the meantime, you know, we have to do what's right. And I know our hospitality industry has been decimated. Mm-hmm. And we're looking at right now, Lane County, probably 90% unemployment in the hospitality industry. So we're going to be talking to people about, you know, if you own a local, you know, big company, Nipsco, for instance, or Family Express, or somebody, you know, instead of going somewhere for meetings, keep those meetings here in Northwest Indiana. Get people out and using the hospitality industry. I was very enthused to hear President Trump talk about bringing back the business deduction for business meals. That will have an impact on our restaurants, which really need right now, really need support. And I'd like to thank everyone who's been going to places and picking up carryout and getting delivery, because it's helping those businesses stay alive. And I really want to express our thanks for that.
Do you get the opportunity, and I'm sure you probably do, maybe off and on, but not on a daily basis, but you get an opportunity to talk with folks in Indianapolis that are your colleagues on a more statewide level. They probably are in touch very often with the governor's office, and of course the governor's watching this all very closely because it all depends on how many cases of COVID-19 that can be abated because of testing and of proper medical treatment and all. But you've got probably got a good idea to get some consulting going on down at the State House to get some clue as to how things are shaping up?
I'm on two calls a week, one nationally with all of my peers from Destinations International. Mm-hmm. It's the 440-plus American Convention Bureaus, plus a number of them from Canada and around the world. And I'm also on a call weekly with the Indiana Travel Association, which is all of the CVBs and affiliated members and Indiana Restaurant and Lodging Association. And indeed, you know, there's a lot of input being provided. I'm confident the governor knows the plight of our industry. I'm confident he's keenly aware, and we're lucky we have a very pro-business governor. I mean, he Governor Holcomb wants to get things open, and he's trying to strike that balance, I think, Chris, that every one of us is how do we do that? You know, where is the, you know, how do we save lives and livelihoods? And I think that's what the governor is very much aware of, you know, in how do we open up casinos safely? How do we open up restaurants safely? I know he's got that message.
I know we've talked about this in the past, and maybe it doesn't seem to be maybe the proper time to bring it up, but we know that here in Lake County in particular, that there's been a lot of juggling around and relocating of organizations, events. This is before the pandemic really hit hard, and that's mainly because of here in Northwest Indiana, we don't have the convention center around any longer. But I know that there are still a lot of efforts that that are trying to get efforts going to get business in, if they can do so, if they're allowed to do so, maybe I should say. Is that still the case, or are we moving closer to some organized effort to try to have some central facility that might be able to take these big events that you'd like to see back in Lake County?
Yes, we were. It's ironic. I think the town of Maryville, you know, is very close. Since White Lodging tore down the Radisson Conference Center that had been, you know, home to a great deal of business, especially in the 90s and early 2000s. And in about 2004, 2005, we were being competitively crushed by Fort Wayne, Indianapolis, other places that had really doubled down on their public space. And I had to cancel a meal between the owner of Century Mall and the town council president and a few others in Maryville. I think we're close, and I think the silver lining for our industry is, Chris, I think finally it took a virus for people in Northwest Indiana to truly understand the value of the hospitality industry. Now they understand what I've been talking about for 30 years. I mean, we're a $1 billion industry to Lake County alone. Mm-hmm. Think about that. We're a $1 billion industry, and it took it being shut down and 90% unemployment for, I think, the average Lake County resident to go, holy cow, there is something here. This is more than just flipping burgers. And I'm hopeful that after this thing starts to lift, that we will be in a position. I really do think Maryville's got the right direction and focus, and I think we're going to be talking about something very exciting in future months.
Well, Sparrows, we're just going to have to wait and see what Governor Holcomb has to say in the next decision about the stay-at-home order, when we're able to start systematically reopening businesses and events and venues here in the state of Indiana and Northwest Indiana in particular. And I hope that we can be back and have some more good news to pass along, too. Thank you for spending time with us today, though.
Chris, you continue to be safe. I look forward to seeing you personally at some point very soon. I'll make sure to stand 6 feet away. You take care.
Thank you very much. Sparrows Bastados is the president and CEO of the South Shore Convention and Visitors Authority, and you're listening to Regionally Speaking on Lakeshore Public Radio. Getting a job can be hard, and if you're a military veteran or even a reservist still serving some time in the military, it's even harder trying to get a job. But there is a new study that's come out from a team of professors at Indiana University Northwestern Gary that have found that hiring veterans is actually good for business. So that ought to be promising for businesses and industries that are looking to, if they haven't already come up with the idea of adding veterans to their workforce. We have with us two of the three staffers that put together the information. We have a veteran himself in his own right, a professor of business administration, Charles Hobson. We have also an economics professor, Micah Pollack. And both of you are in the studio. Thank you for joining us today on Regionally Speaking.
Chris, thanks for having us.
No, thanks for having us.
Well, I understand, Professor Hobson, you are the fellow that came across the information that kind of sparked this idea of doing the study. How did you come across this and your first thoughts in getting the team members involved?
Sure. Chris, we've had many studies over the years that have looked at companies that have been identified as particularly strong in a particular area. So, for example, Fortune does every winter, they do an article on the top 100 companies. Mm-hmm. And we thought if veteran-friendly companies are truly stronger, that if we did a similar study comparing veteran-friendly firms with similar firms and looking at their stock market returns, that we would see a difference between the two.
Now, who did you turn – I'm saying you, I guess it's really a corporation, but we kind of personalize it here. Or what corporation, maybe we should say, did you all turn to in coming up with some of the information that got you started in doing the overall study?
Sure. So there's a magazine called GI Jobs that's published by a company called Victory Media that ranks every year the top 100 military-friendly firms, and we were able to go to their publication and look at their ranking, and you know, we got details about the methodology of how they rank them as well, and then use that as a starting point for the list of military-friendly firms that we'd like to compare with similar firms that are not on that list, that are not identified as military-friendly.
That's probably a term that isn't used often, and maybe it probably should be in the future if it hasn't thought before, of what's called military-friendly. How did you all come up with this definition that you got with not only the data that you had to work with, but also that you wanted to go forth in the future and do more?
Well, GI Jobs has a set of factors that they use to evaluate companies in making the determination that a particular company is military-friendly or not military-friendly. So, for example, one of the factors is the presence of mentoring programs for newly hired veterans. Companies that have those kinds of mentoring programs are more military-friendly than companies who don't have those mentoring programs.
Do you think that maybe it's because that they don't think about, having to kind of go even back even further, they have to take a particular type of person, the veteran we're talking about in this case, somebody who's come off active duty or just finishing up their service, and have to go all the way back to when they were inducted and in turn went through basic training and learn how did that person particularly get into that mindset to be able to survive and function well in the military? You have a certain kind of mindset, I think, that you either, if you don't have it, you learn it when you become by the time you get through with your military service.
Yeah, so one of the things we also did is we looked through the literature and we identified 23 attributes that are often present in those with military training that might translate into a business environment. For example, strong leadership skills, teamwork skills, self-discipline, dependability, loyalty, and the like. And with that list, we have some guidelines for why you might think that an employee that has these characteristics might actually benefit your organization and lead your firm to be more successful.
Mm-hmm. Do you think that, as you discovered, there aren't as many mentoring programs in some of these businesses and industries that are out there that maybe if they learn that they can set up such a program that in turn will help attract more veterans to their workforce?
Yes, that's a point well taken. There are not a lot of companies that have mentoring programs specifically designed for prior military individuals. Mm-hmm. And the results of our study should provide some additional motivation for other firms to consider utilizing some of these more military-friendly features.
Now, Micah, how did you, in going through the data to be able to analyze things together that you work with the GI Jobs list of the military-friendly firms, And it's a list that maybe we should mention, which is not brand new. It's relatively new. It's what, about 3 years old, I think it would be now, almost four?
Well, so it actually began back in 2003, but it's gone through a lot of iterations. And yeah. So in its current form, I believe about 2010 or so is when it kind of stabilized in its current form.
Mm-hmm. And what did you find that these are companies that I guess that not only are out there being well managed because they've done well, you know, from the stock market point of view, from the business point of view, that in turn you could kind of follow through and see that they would be good for veterans?
Yeah, so the way our approach was organized is we first started with this list of 100 military-friendly firms, and then we narrowed it down to 64 publicly traded firms. And for each of those military-friendly firms, we identified a set of similar firms that are in the same industry, similar size, that are not identified as military-friendly. And then using this kind of matched sample, we took the military-friendly firm and compared it with the performance of the non-military-friendly firm or the firm that isn't identified as military-friendly. And what we found is that on average, the military-friendly firms, the stock return was about 5.2 percentage points higher on average, or about 7.2 percentage points in terms of the median higher than similarly matched firms that are not identified as military-friendly.
So I guess it does give at least some indication, at least from this particular set of data that you got, and you're very quick to report this is not a number of years together. It's only a very short period of time, only one report or one set of data, which you can probably follow through in the years ahead, I guess, if you choose to do so. But you can find out whether there is a company or companies are out there that are well-suited for bringing veterans into their workforce. And maybe, as you mentioned, if they don't have the ways to be able to improve themselves so they can attract veterans, that it's possible they could do that then at least. So they're off at least to a good start. Maybe if they aren't initially being military friendly, they're off to a good start with the right information and the right impetus, I suppose, within the corporate boardrooms to be able to bring veterans into the workforce.
Right, Chris, your point is well taken that this is one study in 1 year, and you don't want to get too excited about those results, mm-hmm. but. To date, it's the strongest data that we have building the case, the business case for hiring veterans. We plan to continue our research and our collaboration with GI Jobs. We've got a couple of other studies planned and in the works, but to date, this is the strongest, most definitive data supporting the business case for hiring veterans.
In talking with the folks with GI Jobs and maybe and even talking with getting some of the data together with some of these businesses and industries that you wanted to put together for the study, what kind of reaction have you gotten, at least initially, that they were even interested, that you all were looking into this on a serious basis, not just a frivolous study?
Well, I think that certainly among veterans and those that advise and support and help veterans, this has been a very welcome study. And again, you know, this is only 1 year's worth of data, but part of the reason that we wanted to push ahead with this as quickly as possible and then maybe have a couple more papers down the road that are kind of expanding on this topic is that there, as Charlie said, there really is no empirical study of the value of an organization for hiring veterans. And so this is very kind of a preliminary. It's not undeniable evidence that veterans, returns to your firm are going to be higher if you hire veterans, but it is kind of the first empirical evidence. And I think we've received very warm welcome from those who work with veterans, from firms that are thinking about hiring veterans, from veterans themselves, because it does, kind of put in a quantitative and empirical result, what's going on. And they have something that they can point to and say, look, this is a value to a firm of hiring a veteran.
Mm-hmm. Do you think there's a possibility that since we know that the state administration is very interested in workforce development and helping boost ways to bring more people into the workforce to be able to fill the jobs that are out there? They may be happy to be specialized, but the idea is they have firms that can do this training, get these people hired. If they bring veterans into the workforce, it's number one, it's going to help veterans, to be sure, people looking for jobs, people coming out of the military service and looking for the jobs that they get back into the workforce at home. Or even maybe someplace away from home, like maybe they were living someplace else and not in Indiana. But the idea is that they'll be geared into these jobs, and that in turn is going to help the overall effort within the state of Indiana for more jobs.
Right. A couple of years ago, Chris, we did a week-long workshop with Work One, with veterans who were unemployed.
Mm-hmm.
And we talked to them about the skills that they would need to get hired in the private sector. And I wish we had had the results of this study at that point, because it could have helped to increase their self-confidence, their self-esteem, to know that companies that do a good job hiring veterans outperform similar companies who are not doing a good job hiring veterans.
I understand that we have one other staff member that we haven't mentioned that we should bring into this conversation as a member of the team, and that's finance professor Bala Arshpanali. He was working with all of you, I guess, on this project. What was his this aspect that he was working on in particular?
I actually sought out Micah and Bala because of their statistical expertise. This particular study requires some very high-level statistical analyses, and both Micah and Bala have those skills. So both of them were essential in that regard in terms of doing the statistical analyses.
Did he have anything that he found interesting in the data that he passed on to you and made some remarks in your reports that you've in turn put together for the final report?
Well, I think you may have been a little surprised that the results were what they were, because it is just 1 year and we're dealing with just 64 military-friendly firms. So to get the results we did with such a small sample, I think it was certainly surprising to him and to all of us as well.
Okay. Now, you mentioned you have more projects that are underway. They're planned in the future. Are any of them going to get started as recently as the next semester coming up on the Gary campus, or are you looking down the road even further?
Oh, we've already begun at least two more studies that kind of have resulted from this. Mm-hmm. The first is to look at a longer time period. So rather than just looking at 2016, we're going to go back to 2010 and look at the lists for each year and then track those firms over an 8-year period to see if this is not just a fluke and it's not just something that happened in 2016. And then the second study that we're working on is to get a little more detailed data from GI Jobs and try to figure out, okay, if hiring veterans is beneficial, what is it about hiring veterans that makes it beneficial? Is it, as Charlie mentioned, that you have training programs, or is it that you are making an effort to recruit veterans, or what specifically about being veteran friendly is translating into a higher return and better stock performance?
Now, I have to ask, because of Indiana University, of course, is an academic institution. Are you getting students, undergrad and graduates, involved in some of this work on the projects that you're working? And certainly, that you're going to get some veterans that are going to be, I'm sure, interested. They'll be coming back to class, and if they haven't started school, they'll be starting school, and I'm sure they in turn would like to be interested in finding this own data about themselves, I'm sure.
We did, actually. It's a great question, Chris. We did have an undergraduate who was an Army veteran who worked with us in the early stages of our project and actually presented the preliminary results at a professional conference. So we have gotten veterans involved, as you suggested, and we look forward to doing that in the future. Currently, the gentleman who's the chief operating officer at GI Jobs, his name is Josh Rosen. He's also a veteran and very excited about working with us on the two projects that Micah mentioned.
Well, it sounds like it's data that they can certainly put to good use, as well as you gentlemen at Indiana University Northwest, to be sure. Well, thank you, Charlie, and thank you, Micah, for being with us to talk about this study, and the best of luck in the other studies that you have already underway on the Gary campus.
Great. Chris, thanks for having us
thank
on.
Thank you for having us.
Oh, you're welcome. Charles Hobson is a professor of business administration at Indiana University Northwest, and his colleague with us today is associate economics professor Micah Pollack, and you're listening to Regionally Speaking on Lakeshore Public Radio. And that's it for a special edition of Regionally Speaking. I'm your host, Chris Nolte. Thank you for joining us, and we hope you'll tune in to Regionally Speaking tomorrow.